Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts. Free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate, Sutton Properties. Our new company name, along with my co-host today, Teresa Martin. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Lou.
She's one of our brilliant agents in our firm, and she always has some really interesting questions. Buying and selling homes, land, or farms in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia, give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T Bank, downtown Palo Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our new company website is www.allsuttonproperties, that's allsuttonproperties.com. Just a program note, Dr. Barbie Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m. Make sure you stay tuned. Dr. Barbie always has something of interest. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Sexton. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Lou. How are you?
Doing great, buddy. Glad to have you on the show. Where are you located?
Just outside of Washington, D.C.
All right. And the weather up there is pretty good.
Beautiful October day.
You are a co-founder of the website out there called Terra, T-E-R-R-A, Pulse, Terra Pulse. And that's going to be our subject today. Let me give a little background about you, Joe, if I may. You attended the University of Florida, where you got a degree in wildlife ecology. You got your master's degree at in Utah in forest resources, and you got your Ph.D. in ecology at Duke University, right here in our backyard.
Yes, I did.
You began a podcast at postdoc at NASA to develop the world's first global map of forest cover and change based on the 30-meter resolution satellite image. What do you mean by 30-meter resolution?
So these satellites, these Earth imaging satellites, are essentially high-tech digital cameras in orbit, a couple hundred kilometers up, pointing down. They, like your store-bought digital camera, the camera on your phone, they measure radiation in red, green, and blue wavelengths, but they also measure wavelengths in a variety of other what we call bands, infrared, shortwave infrared, thermal, even radar. When we say 30-meter resolution, that refers to the side of one of the pixels in the image. So a satellite image pixel, the one that we developed for NASA, was 30 meter by 30 meter square, 900 square meter, covering the entire planet.
And there are smaller permutations to that too, right? But down to an inch?
Oh, yeah, down to, I don't think the public has access to imagery with 1-inch resolution, although the military probably does.
Wow.
If you want to get information like that, people typically will fly a plane or a drone, low-flying aircraft.
Teresa, you can run, but you can't hide anymore.
Yeah.
Be under a roof or under a tree.
1 inch. That is amazing.
So Big Brother's here, moving fast. So in 2014, you and your lab mates started TerraPulse, right?
Yeah.
Bunch of excited professors got together and says, hey, we can do something with this. And you started your website.
We published the paper and produced the data set in 2013, and in 2014, we started the company.
Good for you. And that's what we want to talk about today, is your company and what it is and what the benefits are and how it helps people, and then we'll make sure people know how to get in touch with you, Joe.
Sure thing.
One of your first clients was National Geographic. What did you do with them?
So what National Geographic wanted to do was protect the headwaters of the Okavango River and the Okavango Delta. The Delta, if you watch National Geographic or read their magazine or even go to their website now, quite often when you see videos of hippopotamus and elephants and giraffes and wildebeest and all sorts of biodiversity, one of the major hotspots for the world is that Okavango River Delta. extreme. So, and what the Angolan government had suspected was that deforestation was increasing in that watershed. And so what we did for the Angolan government, mediated by National Geographic, who then afterward became an advocate, had become an advocate all along, was to map the current forest cover. We estimated, took the satellite images, applied artificial intelligence to them, and mapped in every pixel the percent coverage of trees for the current year. And then we went backward in time, because these satellites have been in orbit really since the 1970s, and we could map the rates of loss in that watershed and the acceleration of loss. So in a nutshell, what we did is we mapped the current resource value of their land, and then we mapped the threats.
Are you still working with NASA today? I mean, with National Geographic, I'm sorry.
The National Geographic, they just needed us for that one thing to answer your other question. Yeah, NASA is still one of our biggest clients.
So what all do you do for NASA?
We've done a lot of things over the years. We're mapping deforestation in Myanmar. Civil war in Myanmar is the forests are caught between the two sides of that civil conflict. And so what NASA and it's actually Smithsonian is serving the same sort of role that National Geographic was in that one. NASA just, in the larger sense, builds tools of very broad general utility. And then in order to spur innovation in the use of those tools, universities and organizations like Smithsonian will apply for research grants to use those data. So Smithsonian wanted to know what the interrelationships are between civil conflict and deforestation in Myanmar. Another project that we currently have going on is to map the forest cover over the entire boreal region, map the rates of growth. So since we have satellite images going back to the 1970s, we can go backward in time, and any time there was a fire or on the southern end of the boreal forest, if there was a clear cut, a timber harvest, anything like that, we can go back and see how old any standing piece of forest is. We can relate that data to other measurements of the height of the forest and make a map of the entire boreal forest of essentially site index, which is in forestry, it's an estimate of the productivity of any piece of land.
Okay, can you elaborate on why that's important?
Why the growth rates of the boreal forest are important? Because it's tied in with climate change. It's tied in with global carbon budgets. It's tied in with biodiversity. It's tied in with even how natural resource companies can use the land. So if they want to know boreal forest is it's the slowest growing forest on the planet. But on the southern ends, like in British Columbia, Canada, even if you blur your lines a little bit, even dipping down into the United States, knowing how productive any piece of land is allows the economy to adapt to the changing global environment.
Okay.
Now, on the other side, that's the commercial industrial application where NASA data is being used to help the entire economy, the timber economy, adapt to a changing boreal Arctic environment. On the other side, the scientists want to know. Get a better and better picture of what the feedback mechanisms are between the forests and climate change. because the two go hand in hand. A warmer climate in some places will increase the growth of forests. In other places, it will decrease the growth of forests.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I never stopped to even consider about forest having a role in climate change.
Can you say that again, Teresa? I couldn't hear you.
I didn't know that there was a correlation between forest and climate change. That was interesting.
Oh, sure. There's an entire industry developing around carbon banking.
Right.
One of the primary drivers of climate change, especially related to land use, is the amount of biomass in forests. And being in D.C., this is something that we deal a lot with, is that nonprofit organizations and banks and insurance, the entire financial industry and the land use and brokerage industry is getting involved in this as well, is carbon accounting, carbon investing, so that to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, store it in forests, and then ultimately store it in buildings, houses, furniture, etc.
Well, that is really interesting. We've recently done a show on carbon, and this is all. I'm glad that you talked about that because it helped me to understand more about that as well.
You also,
yes, it's all tied in.
Joe, you also, one of your clients is the World Bank. What do you do with them?
Yeah, so, speaking on that carbon economy, what World Bank tries to do is they try to make investments in really long-sighted innovations to spur economic development. Because of this NASA project and because of a project we've done in the Philippines as well, through the U.S. Forest Service, World Bank came to us and they wanted to help the Dominican Republic build a national forest monitoring system so that that country can start getting credit to enter its forest cover into global carbon markets. So what we did, very similarly to the NASA projects, to the National Geographic projects, what they needed to know was where are their forests, and where are their forests being lost, and also where are their forests being gained, because they're just doing a simple accounting. How much forest is on the ground, how much is being lost, how much is being gained, and then project that into the future.
Fascinating. How does this help a real estate agent?
If a real estate agent is interested in if they've got a buyer, let's say, who is interested in anything timber-related, and we can use the example in front of us for carbon, we can, in addition or possibly preemptive to going and performing a timber cruise, a site on-site evaluation, we can provide the information to scan an entire county, an entire state, an entire country, or the entire planet, really, for how much carbon is on the ground or how much forest cover. And carbon's not the only variable that we measure. So we measure, as I said, the coverage of the forest. We measure the age of the forest. We can give information on whether it's pine versus hardwood. So if a buyer were to come to a real estate agent and say, I want to buy 20 to 25-year-old pine stands in Alabama. Your typical agent is going to have a hard time finding all of that information. TerraPulse can provide that information at the click of a button.
Joe, we're going to break you here. This is Let's Talk Land. Our guest today is Joe Sexton. We're talking about how all of this, and we haven't really gotten into because there's a lot to this. We may have to do another show, but how this science and technology that you're a part of would help the real estate agent, the realtor, and specifically the buyers, not necessarily the sellers, but I mean it would help them as well, I would think. Can you started on that? Can you kind of pick up and carry us forward?
Yeah, Yeah, so it was about that same time that we started the company, and we just knew that we had a great technology, and there was going to be some demand for this. We just had to go out and find it. Well, it was right at that time when I was looking to buy a hunting cabin in West Virginia. And so I went on to Zillow and Redfin and Trulia, and I discovered Lands of America, and I discovered a lot of the listing websites. I wanted to – I had bought a couple houses before, so residential properties, and I expected, being a data-centric user in this decade – that I could just search for a property with a how much water frontage, what kind of slopes, what kind of tree cover, all the things that I wanted in a piece of land. And, you know, I couldn't do it. And that's where that epiphany happened, that, you know, we're making these data and producing them at, you know, global scales. We can do this. We've got the technology built.
Right.
And I, who have access to this on my computer screen, can't use it to buy the thing that I want to buy. And I'm sure somewhere out there, and I drove out and met them, there are real estate agents that would love to sell me a cabin with the right amount of tree cover, with the right amount of slope, everything I want. And so that's where that came from.
Man, I like that. That's really cool.
So did you find a realtor that could help you with that?
Well, actually, I found a couple of realtors named Lost River Realty in Wardensville, West Virginia. A couple great guys, but they couldn't – well, obviously, they couldn't help me with it, but we did start talking, and they were very helpful in telling us. My co-founder and I drove out there even and interviewed them and asked them, what do buyers look for? And, you know, what types of buyers do you get? And so we did a lot of our early market and product research, just driving 2 hours outside of D.C. into West Virginia. And we learned a lot of really interesting things. So, for example, a lot of the buyers for this type of property within, say, a two-hour drive of D.C. are people just like me who you've got zooming back out to a global scale, because we do a lot of work for NASA, people are moving into cities around the world. A couple years ago was the first time in the history of the planet where most of the human population of Earth resided inside cities. Now, what's going on economically and technologically, people are moving into cities because jobs are becoming more and more data-centric, and we're getting more and more consolidation and automation of the natural resource jobs. But as people move into cities, they haven't lost their desire, like I did not, to be outside and to have that piece of land, which causes a problem for them to buy land, because their heart knows what they want, but their head is the thing that signs the check. Their head is the thing that makes the decision. So what we had to do is keep that heart engaged, but give their head the Zillow-type experience that they're looking for. And, you know, they told us stories where they'll get folks from D.C. coming out in flip-flops. And they'll say, you know, okay, I want to buy some land. Well, okay, sure, I can help you with that. What are you looking for? Well, I want a big view, and I want to be next to a stream. And the agent would have to say, well, the big views are on the tops of the mountains, and the streams are on the bottom. You're gonna have to make a decision.
And I only want 1 acre of land.
Exactly, I want 1 acre, just big enough for my cabin. And they'd come out in flip flops. You know, and like, well, how are you going to walk that land? And so, you know, it just kept just one piece of evidence. And, you know, being trained as a scientist, we're always looking for evidence. And and just one piece of evidence after another was lining up and showing that there's a real need for this. So to back out the story, we obviously couldn't, you know, scramble the jets that quickly and build me the tool I needed to buy the cabin I wanted in the place. But we used our at that same time, I saw a forest clearing, a deforestation event in the College Park area. And on our web visualization, our web mapping application, I clicked on it. It showed that it had been a forest. It's now in the process of clearing. And then I went and looked it up, and it turns out a Whole Foods was being built there. So what I ended up doing is I bought I found myself a realtor in College Park, bought a house in College Park, and then a couple and I'm actually like I run my part of the company out of this house in College Park, which was such a good investment that I had the ability to retire from being a professor and work full time for the company.
That's a great story, you know, and this is what I'm trying to get at, you know, land education. And I guess I'm probably one of the loudest voices out there. Obviously this show, I think you're podcast number 86, coming up here, but, there's just no land education other than the Realtors Land Institute, which is part of the National Association of Realtors, which I've been a proud member since 98 and actually one of the instructors for the Land 101 course. I've been teaching it all over the United States. Just got back from Tulsa a couple weeks ago, and I'll be teaching one this week, Thursday and Friday in Asheville, North Carolina. But the real estate agents, when they go through the syllabus of getting their license, Teresa, you just went through it a little over a year ago. What do they tell you about land in a real estate course?
They do not tell you a whole lot about land.
So there's a big hole out there for opportunities to for those that do want to specialize in land and farms and ranches to source education. It's just what it is out there. So, but your story is very typical of what we've seen. I've been doing this for almost 30 years. I'm 20, 25 minutes from Winston-Salem and kind of between there and Mount Airy on the Virginia border, 100 miles north of Charlotte. And, you know, we get the Raleigh folks because we have three anomaly mountain ranges here, Pilot Mountain, which is a state park in the name of our town, Siretown Mountain, which is privately owned and by many people, and then Hanging Rock State Park, which is over 7,000 acres state park that probably understands over 600,000 people visit that park. And then you got the Blue Ridge. And the folks from Raleigh, like what you're saying in D.C., you know, they don't want to drive more than 2 hours to enjoy a weekend. If they go into Boone or Blowing Rock, it's another 2 hours. And if they go to Asheville, you know, they spend a whole day just driving to and from to go enjoy a day out in the woods. So, you know, we get a lot of those exactly what you're saying for. And even Teresa, I've called her in flip-flops out showing land. But she's you still wearing flip-flops, Teresa?
No, I wear muck boots.
Okay. You learned, didn't you?
Yes. First jigger bite, I learned.
Well, I'm familiar with that part of the country. It's that high Piedmont, Southern Appalachians. That's beautiful. I'm still, and I'll say it on the air, I'm still looking for my perfect cabin in the mountains.
Well, Teresa, let's see if we can help him out.
Yeah.
We'd be more than welcome. We'd love to have you as a neighbor. So continuing, I want to go back to some of these companies that you guys service. You also, one of your clients is the U.S. Forest Service. Now, that makes sense with what you're doing. What are you doing for them?
So that one's, it's the U.S. Forest Service International Program. And what they're trying to do is outreach to a number of countries. And the one we're helping with is the Philippines. So, again, same thing. Tropical deforestation is a big problem. For many reasons, carbon, climate, biodiversity, watershed health, human health. And so the Forest Service has a department, it's their program, the international program, that helps developing countries build the technology that they need to manage their forests and bring them in a Philippines do through the Forest Service is, again, same thing, map their current forest cover, map the rates of change. Then what they do is they run those numbers, the forest area, through models that estimate the amount of biomass, the amount of carbon on the ground, and then they apply for payments from, it could be World Bank, it could be the Green Climate Fund, international organizations that pay them to conserve their forests. So very similar business model on that whole branch of our business is helping large organizations manage, monitor and manage large acreages of forest. We call it, we provide a Bloomberg for the biosphere.
Are you still doing work with them, Joe?
Yeah, sure are. I didn't go this year, but we go there once a year, down, fly to Manila. It's about a 30-hour flight, which is, again, we're it's the same value proposition as somebody driving from Raleigh or a buyer in Raleigh wanting to go to Boone. We go there once a year, help their staff build the technical capacity. We help them with their computer servers, their cloud architecture, with their data scientists, and we provide them the data streams.
Just off the side, it was a question I wanted to ask earlier. How many satellites are up there flying around United? I'm sure there are other countries, obviously, that's doing mapping.
Oh, I couldn't begin to answer.
They probably wouldn't tell you anyway.
If you're okay with a very wide confidence interval, it's in the hundreds. I know that the ones that we use are, there's about 10 of them, 5 to 10 that we use pretty regularly. There's the NASA USGS Landsat series. There's the, again, the NASA USGS EOS MODIS sensor. That's a coarser resolution, but it's daily. Actually, it's twice daily. And so that one's really helpful for monitoring agricultural productivity.
Okay.
We use some Europeans. So the U.S. has really, really led the way in developing this Earth imaging or Earth observation technology. But since this, since this 2009, and we really are demonstrating the utility of this for both the scientific, academic, and the private sector. European Union, the European Commission of the European Union, launched its own constellation of Earth imaging satellites, and they're providing imagery down to 10-meter and 20-meter resolution. That's very similar to the Landsat data. So there's a couple U.S. satellites, there's a couple European satellites, and then you've got the entire constellation of the private sector satellites that tend to specialize in the very high resolution, like centering around like the 1-meter resolution.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Is there a traffic cop up there?
Well, I would not like to be that traffic cop. There have been a couple international incidents where a couple years ago, and I'm no politician or international relations expert, but China launched a missile to shoot down a weather satellite as a demonstration of their ability to do just that.
Well, yeah, and then there's one up there. They're supposed to be able to go up and grab one and pull it and tear it up. Or something like that.
Yeah, there's going to be trash collectors or like recycling industry. Who knows? The sky's the limit.
Our guest today is Joe. Our guest today is Joe Sexton.
I love it.
This is Let's Talk Land. All right, Joe.
Hey, when you are.
It's another one of your clients is the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. What do you do for those folks?
So the Bureau of Land Management operates under a multiple use mandate, which makes a challenge for them because they've got oil and gas energy development. They've got recreation, which includes outdoor off-road vehicles and hunting, among others. And they've grazing. So what they need is a monitoring system that allows them to see the current state of the land, look at the historical trajectories, and then optimize, say, their grazing intensity on one piece of property, or, you know, on one animal management unit. What we've done for them has shifted a little bit with the changes in directives from above, but we started out taking these satellite data, and as I mentioned before, we map some things at 30 meter resolution, and we update those maps every year. We map other things. We map, for example, vegetation productivity at daily resolution.
Okay.
So between those two, we can see where the forests are and then where the productivity is. In addition to that, we map the water. So every single time a satellite image goes over, one of the first things we do is that pixel water or not? That gives us a dynamic map of water, and it changes every time we get a new satellite image. You can combine those and take the, for example, GPS collars are attached to big game, horned sheep, elk, even mountain lions, and we can take those locations of the animals on any day of the year and figure out where those animals are grouping up. So we're doing this project in Utah, and in Utah, spring climbs the mountains in, depending on where you are, but we'll just, you know, say March to April to May, we call it the green wave, climbs the mountains. And you can see in the GPS data, looking at the satellite images, that the animals are tracking right as that greenness is peaking. They're following it right up the mountain because that's the sweetest grass. Now in the fall, the fall, you know, fall descends back down the mountain, but it also snow is driving that, and we can map snow cover. But all these variables are very similar to the same things that are very similar to just looking at the weather, but instead of looking at what's in the sky, you're looking at what's on the ground. And so with the Bureau of Land Management, we started out mapping mule deer habitat, and then that expanded, and we're also helping them with their sage-grouse management. Now, sage-grouse is a chicken-sized bird, for the lack of a better biological description, nests on the ground. And if this bird goes on the endangered species list, it could be very detrimental to ranching and grazing industry across the western United States. So everybody, private sector, public sector, everybody wants to make sure that this bird is managed, or the habitat is for this, is managed to keep this bird healthy populations. So what we do with for them is we map the productivity of the land, that the where is the sagebrush and grassland communities that these birds rely on for nesting and for feeding, so that the Bureau can coordinate that with their grazing intensity. Another thing we're doing, or another issue that's growing out west, we might not have heard about it too much out east yet, but it is a large and growing issue, is wild horses. So many decades ago, horses were released into the desert, and their populations expanded, and they're continuing to expand, and they're not native to the ecosystem, and so they don't really have a natural predator when they're adults. So their populations are growing out of control. Nobody wants to hunt. Well, the general public doesn't really want to hunt horses like we would when a deer population or an elk population gets out of hand. But they still have to figure out ways to manage these, in coordination with grazing and with outdoor recreation and all the others. So what we do for the Bureau is we create these, we take the satellite data, we apply our machine learning to them to map the habitat dynamically so that the Bureau can monitor and analyze what's the best combination of uses for any piece of land at any point in time.
Wow. This, you know, one of the major things in land is highest and best use. And you're taking this highest and best use methodology to a whole nother level. I can see. I was sitting here trying to visualize some of what you're talking about, and I'm thinking about the fishermen, you know, with the oscilloscopes. You know, they can, you know, put it on their boat, go out in a body of water, and they can find where the fish are. It sounds like you're doing the same thing with satellites now for other land critters.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we have. If any of your listeners are Hunt Stand Pro subscribers, Hunt Stand Pro, the outdoor navigation and hunting app, and I've even talked to several land realtors who use it for seeing property boundaries, et cetera.
Yeah, it's very accurate.
That app is now displaying our tree canopy cover data set.
Wow.
As a layer, as a base map.
How long has that been on their site?
Oh, well, they only launched their premium or their pro edition in the last month or so, but we've gotten about 1 million hits so far. So it's definitely helping people find deer.
Yeah, I'd say. The whitetail guys love it.
Yeah. It sounds like you've made a lot of people's jobs easier as well. This technology, it must have been, it's young and it's so many places that it could go. And you've probably made a lot of people's jobs a lot easier. Because how did they do this stuff? How did they get this information before the satellites?
They didn't.
Wow.
The simplest answer is they didn't get this information. Or not having this information forced realtors to service very small areas. Now, if you're if you sell condos in New York City, you can visit 20 condos, you know, in a weekend day on a typical Saturday. You know, you take your buyer, your client, you show them a bunch, and they've seen a lot. But if you're selling land, there isn't the turnover, there isn't the number of properties, and to get from your office out to any particular property could take you an hour. So before this, agents couldn't service either the extent of an area, or they couldn't serve an area with the intensity that they would like to.
That's true.
So this is, I expect that it's going to be a game changer for the land real estate industry.
Sounds like it. I mean, I what you're talking about and having a good buyer with specific needs. I've spent 2 and 3 days. Going to 2 different states and multiple counties, previewing these properties. But, you know, I've learned, too, is to use the technology, and I teach it to Teresa and our other agents. You know, we've got a lot of good technology, and used to we'd just meet somebody, and we'd have to go to the mapping office and get an old blueprint of the tax map, or maybe several if it was lapping over several maps, and put it up on a window, and take the old Corps of Engineer map and take a pencil and draw the contour lines. And, even today in our office, we try to stay ahead or up with the technology. And that's why we wanted you on the show, because we're selfish. We want to be one of the first ones to understand and use and help proliferate. But, it is becoming easier, but it's getting the word out about these resources to the agents. That can help them is, to me, a problem, and again, a reason for our show.
Yeah, and that's the reason I'm a member of the Realtors Land Institute. That's been
you're a national sponsor. We truly appreciate
it. For me to learn about the industry, as well as to get the message out.
Well, you've got the best in an industry that's in our organization. I can tell you that right now. It's a real privilege to be part of such a variety of knowledge. And we gather. I hope we'll see you in San Antonio here next year for our land conference. One of your commercial clients is Enviva Biomass. I hope I'm saying that right. They are a major supplier for wood stove pellets in Europe. Why is your website important to them?
Or your services? Yes, Enviva is, they're based out of Maryland, and they are the number one supplier of wood pellets to the European market. And they've got mills around, all across the southeastern United States, all across the coastal plain. And they have two benefits from this. The primary benefit is they're in the green energy business, and they want to communicate to the local landowners and to the world, really, that they are not causing net deforestation. When Enviva puts down a mill, they want to show the world that the timber within that, the coverage of timber in, like, say, a 75-mile catchment radius of that mill stays stable. Now they're gonna buy from suppliers who are harvesting here and planting there, but they want to communicate to the world. It's called their track and trace program. That when Enviva is in the neighborhood, the forests stay around. And on the other side, just in internal business, their supply chain cannot suffer a decrease in the amount of wood available to their mills. Those mills are very expensive to build, I'm sure. And what they need to do is monitor the supply in their wood basket. So what we do for them, as with National Geographic and the World Bank for the Dominican Republic and U.S. Forest Service for the Philippines, is we monitor the state of the forests, how much acreage within their mill shed, or sorry, their catchment is forested, and what are the loss rates, what's the age class distribution, and when the provider of wood material to their mills cuts a piece of land, harvests a piece of land, in 2 or 3 years, does it show back up as forest again? Because they have agreements with their suppliers that when Enviva buys wood from a site, that site will be replanted as forest. So they need to verify that action, that reforestation, replanting, is in fact occurring. They need to monitor the entire catchment area for the mill, and then they need to communicate that they are good stewards of the land to the public.
What a great service, I tell you. I'm sure there are other manufacturers that could utilize the same thing, Joe. On your website, you go into three specific categories that you're identifying where you guys feel that you can help. And one of them is agriculture, and you say precise local monitoring and assessment to improve yields from field of globe, ensuring that the food security for over 7 billion people requires adaptation to climate, economic, and technological changes. Our cropland data sets are updated daily and provide within field resolution to enable the precision agriculture monitoring, prediction, and investment. Whether you need the resolution to manage a family farm or a long-term or global consistency for ag business or crop insurance, you provide satellite vegetation indices, mapping summaries of recent and long-term norms and visibility, crop types and productivity, and plant stress and drought severity. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, similar to mapping forests and mapping rangeland across the western United States, we can mine from those satellite images the information on the productivity of the field. So one of the variables that we measure or extract from the imagery is called the normalized difference vegetation index. It's a metric, kind of like the Dow index or the NASDAQ of -1 to 1, anything above 0 or anything above, say, 0.1 is vegetated. And then between 0.1 and 1 is more and more leaf canopy area. Up is more, down is less. And for any location, you can click on that spot, and it'll tell you how productive that either that pixel, that field, that farm, up to that county has been back to, we've got data going back to about 2000. And since we are fusing data from different satellites, some of them is 500-meter resolution twice daily. Other data is 30-meter resolution every 8 or 16 days. We fuse all those data sets together to provide a stock ticker for any location that anybody might be interested in. That has let us see the change. So we've watched fields. Well, we've watched timber in Georgia and South Carolina, Florida, turn from pine plantation, get harvested, and then within a couple years, it starts showing a corn signal. Or it'll show corn, soy in the Midwest. So we can automatically, from the satellite images, detect what type of crop has been on that piece of land in the past, and up until really where we are now with the technology is mapping it for the previous year. If when we're talking about the current year, it takes a whole season of data to really get a good estimate of what was on that piece of land. But what we can map up until about last week is how productive is that piece of land. So we can see, when you see these on the Weather Channel, you see a drought map, and it's these big blobs of the drought cover the entire southeastern United States. Well, anybody that has a farm knows that even different fields within their farm are affected by that drought differently. So that's what we mean by when we say precision agriculture. We can go from these big county level or state level assessments down to being able to see within your individual property how is it performing. And that's for the farmer or the manager or the owner to monitor their property or their portfolio of many properties, and then it also helps the buyer when a piece of land comes onto the market to assess what is the historical performance of this piece of land,
and then project the future performance as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just thinking, this technology is a real game changer. There's so many uses for it. Where do you see the technology going in the future?
Just a guess.
I know.
It's wild where it's going. So what I see is I'll even back up a little bit into the past. So what has been happening and is continuing to happen is, once that 2009 was that watershed moment when the U.S. government released those satellite images, they created an industry. And then other countries and even the private sector started launching their own satellites. And we were sort of in a new space race for having the best technology to monitor the biosphere. And so we've got the satellites being launched, more and more satellites of more and more different wavelengths, so we can see different things. Some satellites detect moisture. Some satellites detect the height of vegetation, so we can map increasingly the heights of trees. We can, and this is all working with NASA, USDA, that's like the big federal agencies are really working hard to develop these products that are far more useful to the American people than they have been. I mean, this information has never existed before. Then you've got on the application end, all sorts of businesses are cropping up to increase the efficiency and the responsivity of natural resources, the forestry, the farming, the ranching, even the recreation, to be more, as I say, like to alleviate the information illiquidity in that market. And then there's companies like our own, and we're really probably, like not to toot our own horn, but we're sort of breaking trail in this segment, where we're applying the machine learning to those imagery, to those images, and distributing them to that variety of users. So big data, everybody's talking about big data now, but big data is not a solution. Big data is a problem. What you want is not data, you want information. And so as these satellites and radar satellites are being launched that can map the heights of trees, there are satellites now that can map a change in elevation of the ground of a few centimeters. So if you're in, say, on the San Andreas Fault in California, you can map when an earthquake changes the elevation of your property, or coastal subsidence as sea levels rising on one side, in some places, Chesapeake Bay being one of them, or the Chesapeake Bay watershed, many places, the land is sinking from geologic processes. It would take a very long time to describe all of the different satellites that are being launched. The Amazon, Google, Microsoft, the big tech data companies are providing cloud architectures for companies like TerraPulse to build businesses that provide scalable solutions. And then the applications are all cropping up. And, I mean, we've gone through 7 or 8 of them just that our company is doing, just that TerraPulse is doing. So just across the board, there's something between a wildfire and a revolution happening.
Yeah, this is really exciting.
Actually, speaking of wildfire, there are the insurance industry is even picking this up and being able to buffer the risk, I guess, of land ownership in places where wildfires are a problem. So I could ramble on forever. You got to be careful with me because I have been a professor. But it really is all across the board.
Well, it's really interesting. It's kind of making me think about, I've been watching PBS and watching where they put the first man on the moon and how exciting it was and if you think about where it's gone from there in the short time that we've had since a man was put on the moon. And you think about this and where it can go, it's really exciting.
Wait till G5 gets out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and we have one of our algorithms maps for every location on the ground. We take an elevation map, a gridded elevation map, and we can drop a pin on that map and show you every location that is visible from that spot. And then we can apply that algorithm to every pixel in the satellite image and show you what are the best spots for someone to place a cell phone tower.
Wow.
Or build a house with a panoramic view.
Yep. Well, we call it view score.
View scores. Unbelievable. Well.
Yeah, and Teresa, to speak to your point about this sort of exponential pace of technology, I saw my first satellite image, my moment, my big aha moment, was in the summer of 1998. I was cruising timber in the panhandle of Florida as a fire ecology research intern when I was in college. And so during the day, from about 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., I would be out in the July and August sunshine, bushwhacking through longleaf pine stands, quail plantations, beautiful country, and GPSing the basal area of the trees, essentially, canopy cover basal area. And then at night, I taught myself GIS in the lab, the little field station, and we had one of those Landsat satellite images. They were, I think, $4,500 a piece at the time. These were just diamonds that when somebody got one, it was just amazing. And I saw that image, and I zoomed, looked at where I was, and zoomed out, and zoomed out, and zoomed out. And the next thing I know, I'm looking at the entire panhandle of Florida, and my little field cruise, or my timber cruise, was this tiny speck. That was 1998.
Wow.
And I came back to the University of Florida and told my department chair, this is what I'm going to do. How can we make the rest of my education put me in a position to make maps from these satellite data? It took, and I actually went to Utah State University specifically because it was, well, one, it was as far as I could go ecologically, without, and still speak English, going from the humid, rainy, flat Florida flatwoods up to the southern margin of the boreal forest and out to high desert sagebrush country to work with those satellite images. And then in 2005, 2006 is when the whole world saw Google Earth and Google Maps. And so that is that long, slow, flat part of the technological growth. And what we're seeing now is just this rapid acceleration. But up until now, it's been all root growth, right? We've been putting down these tap roots into the soil of the technology and the application and the computer science and the imaging. All that is coming together, and it's now coming together where we're just in an incredibly exciting time.
Joe, this is a good place to kind of wrap up our show. You want to give our listening audience how they can get in touch with you and your company, your websites, your phone numbers, anything else you want?
Sure. The TerraPulse website is www.terrapulse.com. That's TerraPulse.com. My number is 919-699-7819. And my email, you can get it on the site, but it is Sexton, Sexton, at TerraPulse.com.
Wow, you've been a terrific guest. What do you think, Teresa?
I think this is my favorite show that we've done.
You do?
I do. I really enjoyed this.
Joe, you've been phenomenal.
I like Joe. I'm married to Joe, so I work well with Joe's.
Yeah, you do. Oh, goodness.
Had a good time.
All right. Hang in here with us. I'm going to close this out. All right?
Okay. Yep.
Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. All of our shows are broadcast from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. every Saturday morning, and downloaded on our master website, Let's Talk Land. That's letstalkland.net, also on Podbeam and Spotify. My email is lou, at mylandpro.com. My cell is 336-669-1405. Teresa?
My phone number is 336-209-2937, and my email is teresa.mylandpro@gmail.com.
Rodney, how they get us at the station?
They can go to our website, Lou, go to WKTE1090.com, and also they can download the Simple Radio app and hear us throughout the whole entire world.
Beach music and oldies and beach just and happy oldies. Music.
That's right.
We're a happy music
happy,
station.
Happy, happy, happy music.
And we've been awarded 5 years in a row.
5 years in a row as being the number one beach and oldies radio station on the East Coast here.
And you got an excellent award not too long ago.
Yes, I did there. Thank you. It's announcer of the year for 2019.
We're proud of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We'll see you next week. Stay tuned for Dr. Barbie.